The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Join rubab master Humayun Saki for his first performance in Oregon and sitarist Josh Feinberg for short solo sets. Then they will play a set together in the second half of the concert. Refreshments and concessions will be served. Again, that's Afghanistan to India, a rubab sitar duet, on Saturday, April 7th at 7 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
That's right. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Coming up now is a special edition of Fight the Empire on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, hosted by Per Fogering. He is going to speak with William Pepper, who has written the book, The Plot to Kill King.
Direct from our newsroom in Washington, in color, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite and Russ Hodge in Memphis, Tennessee, Dan Rather in New York, Bernard Kalb in Saigon, Marvin Kalb in Wellington, New Zealand, and Bert Quint in Khe Sanh, South Vietnam.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio-equipped car containing two white men. Dr. King was standing on the balcony of a second-floor hotel room tonight when, according to a companion, a shot was fired from across the street. In the friend's words, the bullet exploded in his face. Police, who have been keeping a close watch over the Nobel Peace Prize winner because of Memphis' turbulent racial situation, were on the scene almost immediately. They rushed the 39-year-old Negro leader to a hospital where he died of a bullet wound in the neck. Police said they found a high-powered hunting rifle.
Well, this is Per Fogering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my guest today is William Pepper, who is an attorney, and he was a colleague of Martin Luther King. And he's written three books on Dr. King's assassination. The latest book is The Plot to Kill King, and that's the one we'll be talking about today. So, William Pepper, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Can you, why don't you tell us about your connection to Dr. King?
Well, I was a journalist in Vietnam. And I kept all of my notes and my tapes and photos private with me. Never developed anything there. And came back from Vietnam and was horrified by the atrocities that the American government was committing. So I did an article in Ramparts magazine called "The Children of Vietnam," which went through the travesty and the savagery of the war, and the victims, mostly innocent children and elderly people. Martin King was a subscriber to Ramparts, and he saw that article when he was going through his mail on his way to Jamaica at the Atlanta airport, and it shook him, but because he just saw the photographs, he didn't have time to read it, and the photographs shook him. He then had a chance to read it in detail, And he asked to meet with me at when he came back. I met him early in 1967, and up in Providence, Rhode Island, actually, he was speaking at Brown University, and we rode from Providence to Cambridge, to Harvard, and opened Vietnam summer there. He then decided to give this well-known anti-war speech in on April 4th, 1967 at Riverside Church, where he first time proclaimed his unequivocal opposition to the war and called the Americans the greatest purveyors of violence on earth. That cost him dearly in terms of money. He was withdrawn from his organization. He was termed a traitor, and it was not a good outcome for him, either financially or personally, because of the attacks that were made upon him. However, we started to work closely together and decided, with his permission, to launch a possibility of a third-party candidate for President of the United States with the King and Benjamin Spock as his vice president. I announced that on the 15th of April in front of the UN, a massive rally. It was very well received, and so we thought we were on the way. We started to develop a convention of 5,000 delegates. It'll be held in Chicago at the Palmer House. And we worked toward that, and we brought that convention into being. Martin was the keynoter. I spoke first and introduced him. And then he started to speak. As he was speaking, a note was passed to me over my shoulder, which said, "Get him out of here after he speaks, or we will take him hostage and make him embarrass him before the world." So after Martin spoke, I had to go up to him and talk to him about that, and it was decided the best thing was, in fact, for him to leave. They didn't want a unifier, and so they were successful. What we didn't know at that time was that the Black Caucus that was demanding this and had put forward many, many resolutions had been organized by the Blackstone Rangers, a Chicago gang, in cooperation with Richard Daley and the American Department of the Interior. And they their resolution was to destroy the convention. And they were successful. We were young and we were naive. And we didn't have our own proper security. And they passed wide ranges of anti-Semitic resolutions. And those simply drove away all of the Northern liberal Jewish money from that movement. So we were stopped dead in our tracks. That's a long-winded way of answering mm-hmm. your question, but there it was after Labor Day 67.
Well, now, just a couple of weeks after that Riverside Church speech, James Earl Ray escaped from Missouri prison, and in your book you tell how that escape was arranged, that the warden of the prison was paid $25,000 to kind of get let James Earl Ray escape. But you also say that this is planned earlier. This is planned before the speech
They organized this with the warden back in November, December of 1966, yes. Tolson carried the money in.
Clyde Tolson, he's the number two man in the FBI.
He was number two man in the FBI, carried the money in and gave it to Russell Atkins, who was the head of the Dixie Mafia group that was collaborating for the assassination.
And then so James Earl Ray did escape, And
James never knew this.
He did not. Right. He did not know that his escape was being arranged, and he kind of headed for Montreal. So, what happened there?
Well, he did some an odd job, and he then moved up into Canada. Eventually, got over to Montreal. Was given, though, in Canada en route, was given an alias called Eric Galt, and Eric Galt worked for a company that had a warehouse in outside of Toronto that required him to have security clearance. So, by giving James all the details and documentation of this alias, it meant that if he was ever picked up, they would run a check on that name, and he would immediately be released. But he was then on his way to try to talk somebody into giving him traveling papers so he could get out of Canada and get to Europe, where he wanted to then go further on into Africa. He went when he was in Montreal, he went to a bar on the waterfront where sailors congregated and merchant seamen came in and so forth. And that's where he met Raoul. And Raoul befriended him and made him believe that he would get him traveling papers, but he would have to do some favors for Raoul first. And that was involved going back in the United States and things of that sort. So James was willing to do that. Raoul gave him the money to buy a car, which he did when he got into Birmingham. He bought this white Mustang car with Raoul's money. And he was also seen in the bar by a British merchant seaman who gave us a statement that he recognized James, and he had been talking earlier with Raoul and was being offered guns for sale. Raoul seemed to have access to.
Now Raoul was
identified. He did a mm-hmm. photo identification of Raoul.
Now Raoul was working for the CIA.
Well, he was working. Raoul was a British nationalist, and he was a merchant seaman. Mm-hmm. He wasn't working for CIA. I'm sorry, you're talking about Raoul. You're not talking about the merchant seaman.
No, Raoul.
You're talking about Raoul.
Mm-hmm.
Raoul was working for, certainly working for military intelligence and probably the agency. He was a Portuguese special guy who came over before the Kennedy assassination, and he had been, I believe, doing intelligence work for Portugal as an agent in Angola. So he had those connections to get him into the country. Did he link up with the agency? Yes, probably so. A lot of these guys wear two hats at least, as you may know. John Downey, who was the head of 902nd Military Intelligence Group, was also a CIA officer. And he was the briefing colonel of Lyndon Johnson throughout the war. So Raoul was there waiting and effectively and befriended James and was going to give him this kind of assistance. That's how they met, and that's how they began their relationship.
So then James spent a lot of time doing sort of smuggling jobs for Raoul. He was in L.A. for a while and Mexico, and then he wound up in the Southeast. He bought a rifle in Birmingham, and then he went up to Memphis. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And then we'll get to Memphis.
Well, yes, he did small smuggling jobs for Raoul over the border from Canada in and out of Mexico. He was sent to Los Angeles, and he was there for quite a period of time. the Army sniper unit we identified also, two of their snipers were also in Los Angeles, and they were there for quite a while. Then all of a sudden they were told to go to New Orleans and into Louisiana, and they didn't know why. They just followed the orders and they went. James was also instructed by Raoul to go into the South and to leave Los Angeles, and he just followed the instructions he was given. What people didn't realize at the time was the reason these people were moved. Martin King was to have been killed in Los Angeles, but the planning to kill Robert Kennedy was underway at that time as well, because the Los Angeles Convention, the Democratic Convention, would likely nominate him, and they didn't want him nominated or obviously president, so they were going to, they made up their minds to hit him in Los Angeles. They couldn't have two assassinations in such a short period of time, so they moved the one assassination effort into Memphis, moved everybody who was involved in that one there, and L.A. was clear for the second assassination effort. So James worked with Raoul for a reasonable period of time doing things, and he was instructed to go to Birmingham and buy that rifle. He bought the wrong one, came back, showed it to Raoul. Raoul said, "This is not the right one. You got the 35mm Remington of a particular type," and he showed it to him in the catalog, and James went back with the rifle and exchanged it. He took the changed rifle up into Memphis, but outside of Memphis, the night before he went into the city limits, he stayed at a motel, and Raoul met him there and took the rifle from him. That rifle was to be the throwdown gun. It was not to be the shooting weapon, but the throwdown gun. And so Raoul took it and controlled it, and it was dropped in the bundle of James's things near Knipe's store, it's a store on New Main Street. Not by James, because when he got into Memphis, met Raoul. Raoul told him to go upstairs and rent a room, which he did. He rented the room and he brought his things up and left his things there. And then Raoul told him that he would be having meetings with some gun sellers and James didn't need to be around, so he told him to go away. James realized he had a flat spare tire in the Mustang and knew he'd get hell if Raoul had a problem and didn't have a tire to put on the car. So he went to change that tire up at a local gas station. He was observed by two witnesses whose statements were buried that we eventually found. Two witnesses coming out of Jim's Grill saw him a couple of blocks later as he came in the car, made a right turn, and they were just about to cross the street there, and they saw him driving up to the gas station. So that's where he was. The time of the killing, he was up at that gas station, tried to get back down, because he heard the sirens, was tired of waiting, tried to get back down, but he was waved away by the police, who kept everybody away from that area. So he then headed for Atlanta, and he started on his northern journey from there.
Well, maybe this would be a good time to set the scene. I wish we had TV so you could do a little map or something, but the rooming house and Jim's Grill were on South Main Street in Memphis, and the motel, the Lorraine Motel, where Dr. King was staying, was one block over on Mulberry Street. And from the back windows of the rooming house, you could look across a kind of an empty lot, an overgrown shrubby lot, and then you see Mulberry Street, and then on the other side of that street, you see the motel. So from the back windows of the rooming house, from that backyard, you had a clear view of the Lorraine Motel. So we'll get to Lloyd Jowers later on. There was also the Alpha 184 sniper unit. They were also in town, and they were on the roof of the Illinois Central Railroad building. Tell us about that.
One sniper,
oh, okay.
One spotter were there.
Mm-hmm.
Only one. Another one, we believe, were on top of the. It was on top of the water tower. So there was four of the eight. Then they had a communications guy and the two leaders. But they were there as a. They didn't know they were there as a backup. They thought they were there to carry out the killing, and they were briefed at 4:30 that morning in Count Shelby, shown photographs of Martin King and Andrew Young, told they were enemies of the state and they had to be eliminated. So that was their preparation. They came and they took up positions in Memphis. And they had to wait for an order to fire, and they wouldn't fire without the order. So they really were the backup to the civilian, who really wasn't a civilian. He was a Memphis police officer. His effort to try to kill them.
Who were the snipers? Were they actually in the Army or the Reserves or what?
They were in the Army, and they were. They were special unit people who were trained snipers.
Mm-hmm. And there's also some kind of a camera team, a PSYOPS camera team on the roof of the fire station, which also overlooked the motel. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, Downey chose two people as photographers and put them. Wanted to put them on the roof of the fire station. The fire chief and head of that particular station got them up there and let them set up. And they were there to take photographs of all the events, photographs of everyone up and around the balcony and everyone below the balcony and up into the bushes where. Presumably they were looking for any witnesses or anyone they could see. I think that was Downey's concern.
Who was Downey again?
John Downey is the head of the military intelligence group, mm-hmm. the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, the only one that's based in the Pentagon.
Well, let's get back to Lloyd Jowers. He was he owned Jim's Grill. He's also, for a brief period, he was a Memphis policeman himself, and he made a kind of a confession. Actually, I guess it was on TV about how he arranged for the assassination or helped carry it out. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Jowers didn't arrange anything. He was he was just a minor player who owned Jim's Grill, and his job was to go out in the bushes with the shooter and the spotter, and to take the rifle from the shooter after he had shot and bring it back in to the kitchen, which is exactly what he did. And for that, he was paid. He was paid $100,000 in cash, which he kept in an unused oven, and his gambling bills to Liberta were forgiven. So that's what Jowers did. As he brought the smoking rifles into the kitchen, he brushed by Betty Spates, who had been his playmate and bedmate, and
she also worked there too.
Sorry?
She also worked there also.
Well, she worked there off and on. She wasn't working that day. She was working across the street, but she came over around the fateful time to see Lloyd. So he was there with them, and in comes the police. He after the shooting, and he had put the rifle on a shelf under the counter, and it stayed there. And of course, he knew nothing, and no one in the grill knew anything about the details of the actual shooting. But the police interrogated them and got as much information as they could.
Well, now, Lloyd Jower's statement, he said that he was approached by a local businessman, and then later on he was approached by a man named Frank Liberto, who was a Memphis produce dealer, and said that he'd been picked because of the grill's location. And he also said that he was visited before the assassination by Raul with a decoy rifle. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, Raul ultimately put the rifle along with James's belongings upstairs in the room that James rented. That room was used to stage the assassination. So they met there. Frank Strausser, who was the shooter, met Raul and his spotter Earl Clark. They were all up there. Knipe maintains, who's the shop owner, that the bundle that was dropped down of James's things was dropped down actually some minutes before the shooting. So it's very interesting. The person who picked them up and ran downstairs, and who I believe probably drove away the real assassin, was Bob Blakey. And there had to be some kind of consensus for those rifles to be examined, but they would not match the shooting rifle in any event.
So these people are waiting in the bushes behind Jim's grill, and then Martin Luther King was staying at the Lorraine Motel, which is I guess not his usual place he stayed in Memphis, was it?
I'm sorry, what was that again?
The assassins were waiting for Martin Luther King to at the Lorraine Motel, but that motel was not where King usually stayed in Memphis.
No, he never stayed there. Which troubled me with his by a statement of Abernathy's that this is our room, this is where we always stayed. Well, first of all, they never stayed there. They did meet community people there to make where they felt more comfortable and more at home. So they did meet some community people there. But they never stayed overnight there, and certainly never in room 306. Martin was in room 202, which was a secure room. And they had to move him out of that room because they couldn't get a clear shot of him there. They would have moved, so that's what they did. They moved him up to 306, and where there was no question that they had a clear shot of him. Billy Kyles used to say all the time, Bill's career, that he went in to Martin's room in 306 minutes before the shooting and helped him get dressed and joked with him and so forth. Well, Kyle's a liar because he never did that.
Well, tell us who Billy Kyles was.
Billy Kyles, a local minister who really was not privy to in any way a lot of the documentation that we were able to obtain, but he wanted to help out as much as possible on the work, so he let him in. But it was not with a great deal of enthusiasm.
So then King, when he stepped out on the balcony at 6 p.m., he was killed. He was shot once, and he didn't die instantly, but. Several witnesses had seen the shooters or people be in those bushes behind the cafe, and had seen people running after the shots are fired. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's it wasn't an easy situation at all. James was told to leave the rooming house room. He left, and he went, as I said earlier, to get this tire fixed, and then was chased away and ended up driving to Atlanta. Raul is probably the person who dropped the bundle, which included the gun that if you understand the different caliber gun that he had taken out and had exchanged. So he got rid of that in the Kansas dump truck. But the web is getting closer and closer to James. There's no question about that. How are you going to play that particular piece?
Pardon me?
Yes.
So when the shot was fired, several people had. A driver, King's driver, Solomon Jones, saw a man come out of the bushes and jump down the wall. A cab driver named Buddy Butler also saw a man jump from the wall and get into a police car. And this is all filmed by the Army photographers. The bundle that was dropped in front of that store up on South Main Street, that was found, and did that rifle have James's fingerprints on it or what?
Yes, it did, but it didn't have I think it had one thumbprint. Mm-hmm. But it couldn't have been the murder weapon. The bullets never were never capable of being matched. So it was just a throwdown gun. Mm-hmm. And it was the final throwdown gun that James had bought. And any investigative authority want to look into it, that's clearly what they would have found.
So then James, actually did get out of the country, and he was arrested. It was about a year later, a few months later in England, and brought back. And he was sort of assigned a lawyer who advised him to plead guilty, which he did, but then he changed his mind. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, he was certainly uneasy with respect to legal representation, and he fired the Haineses, the Haines father and son, and that was probably his biggest single mistake, because they were determined to go to trial. They were not going to play along with the government's role. The government wanted this 99-year sentence, and they wanted the case closed. He wasn't going to cooperate with that, and so he fired the Haineses. He brought on a lawyer who was a well-known criminal trial lawyer in Texas, and promised him a trial, and then gradually went away from it and advised him he had to plead guilty.
That was Percy Forman.
It was Percy Forman who did that. And Percy apparently had a bad heart, and that was the reason for the medical excuse. For the client, but Percy Forman did intervene at that point and tried to, well, I want to say, acculturate James, make him more likable than he had been previously. So that is what happened. He didn't he was sort of tried, but he was committed not to make any sounds or efforts in dissent, because that would break the plea bargain deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he cooperated until he finally got to the point where they made him a capital prisoner. But Percy gave his brother $500, told James, "I'm not able to defend you. I'm got questions with my health." When he said that, James knew that he wasn't going to get an adequate defense, and so he fired. Well, he didn't fire him. He let Percy go, but he started to try to bring on other lawyers to get a trial that he's never had.
Mm-hmm. Well, so then James Earl Ray was sentenced to 99 years in prison. At what point did you and the King family believe that he was innocent?
Well, I probably had it in mind a lot longer than them, but they believed it virtually up to the end of early 2018, and looking for a curb into which the White Mustang could be pulled, which was right next to the house. I think that's probably what they did.
Well, now tell us about the Lloyd Jowers told his story, and there were witnesses who saw him with that the rifle that he got from the shooter, and the King family filed a civil suit. There was never a real trial of James Earl Ray, but the King family filed a civil suit against Lloyd Jowers and other people. And tell us about that.
Well, we brought the civil action in 1999. I represented the family at that point. And our thinking was to bring an action against Jowers, because there was a lot of evidence of some involvement of his. We could probably talk our way into an evidentiary situation. We were really the only thing we wanted, you know, aside from Bob's being well, was the vegetables, with the fruits, with the things that were on the farms that he was growing, and he thought he was trying to make them safe, which in effect he was. Basically being safe, and so he could use them for his chemotherapy.
There was a civil trial in Memphis, and the jury heard witnesses, and their verdict was that the killing was done by who?
Wait, I'm sorry. The civil trial was in Memphis. Mm-hmm. We called 70 witnesses over mm-hmm. a 30-day period. It took the jury only 59 minutes to decide that James Earl Ray was not guilty of the crime. Mm-hmm. But in fact, agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and city of Memphis, along with a minor player, Lloyd Jowers, in terms of percentage of liability, but that those were the guilty parties and the libel parties for the guilty verdict, and James's role was so small in reality that they were discussing the possibility of letting him go. That's still another matter.
Well, I know this. The story of that verdict was in the papers. I remember seeing it in the Oregonian. It was on a back page, and it's just amazing to me that here's his verdict, but nothing was ever done about it, as far as I know. What was the reaction when this verdict happened?
I'm sorry, when the reaction when what?
Well, when this Memphis verdict came out, there was a brief mention in the papers, and then that seemed to be the end of it.
Yeah, there was no serious mention. It took the jury 59 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
They clearly heard the case, knew what the facts were, and found correctly for the family. There was no reaction because there was no coverage. Corporate media stayed out of the courtroom throughout the entire trial, first saying, "Oh, this is the world class trial, and we must put that up there, and we must cover it." Then they didn't show up. Court TV was going to cover it. It didn't bother. So we had that situation where the media would come in only when Coretta King was testifying or Dexter or a member of the family, but would disappear when the real evidence was being heard.
It seems strange to me that there's no outrage. I mean, there was no outrage over or any kind of movement to find the real killers. It was just kind of buried. I find that very troubling.
Well, it should be troubling, but to this day. The FBI will maintain that James Earl Ray was the killer. Department of Justice Kowalski, who did the investigation, will maintain that James was the shooter.
Mm-hmm.
Blakey, House Select Committee, will stick with his position. Despite the fact that in my book, The Plot to Kill King, I give extraordinary depositional evidence that is not what happened. And I prepare to tell history how Martin King really was killed. But they're not interested in that, you know, they're just simply not interested. The first time we've had any serious corporate media attention on the real facts of the case was today. In the Washington Post online has today a major, what will be a front page article on Sunday or Monday on my work and on the case. Where they set out the involvement of Hoover and Tolson and put forth a great deal of information that has never been revealed before.
Well, I might say that this is being recorded on Friday, and this will probably be played sometime next week, so by then the Washington Post story will have appeared.
That's right.
We are talking with William Pepper, who is an attorney who has written three books, the most recent being The Plot to Kill King. And I might say that this book, it's a rather long book, but over half of it seems to be appendices, court testimony, court documents, and so there's plenty of evidence. So...
I insisted with the publishers in putting in all of the depositions, the key evidentiary depositions, the court trial, everything to back up what I was saying in the text of the book. I didn't want to be accused of taking things out of context or mm-hmm. making things up. So I put forth all of the evidence sworn under oath, and it's there. And all one has to do is to plow through it, obviously. But it is all there.
So, but there are was there any kind of investigation at all, congressional investigation of this?
Well, the House Select Committee on Assassination started in 1976, and they they investigated the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., but it was just a patsy investigation. It was set up to come out with a conclusion they did, and it really supported the official stories, despite all the evidence to the contrary.
So there were people involved in this who were, I guess Lloyd Jowers told his story on primetime TV. Also, he was a witness in the Memphis civil suit, but none of the were the other people who worked for Jowers at the cafe who had seen him with that rifle. They were never testified any place. Is that correct?
No, there was Betty Spates held her story from 1968 to 1994 when I finally got her to tell the truth. That she saw Lloyd bringing the rifle, still smoking rifle, in through the back door of the grill, breaking it down and taking it out front and putting it under the counter. Betty was the only one who had that kind of any people who worked there. She was the only person who had that kind of evidence. Her sister, who worked at the place, did tell us that Lloyd got $100,000 put into a unused stove, and Lloyd admitted that. When the reason we had the civil we were able to get the civil trial with him as a defendant was that he spoke to myself and Dexter King, and then Dexter and Andrew Young spoke to him, and he told the same story that he was involved. He was paid to do what he did with the rifle, to bring it in, hold it, and give it to Raoul the next day when Raoul came around. So his story was consistent. He became a defendant. He was afraid he was going to be indicted and charged. Little did he know, of course, that the fix was in and that was never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But he enabled us to have the civil trial and to bring out all the evidence that we needed to bring out.
So here we have a plot involved people from the CIA, the FBI, and the Memphis police, and the Mafia. And I see that last year, the Lorraine Motel is now the home of the National Civil Rights Museum. And you gave a book talk there last year. How did that book talk go over?
Very well. It was a packed audience, the first time they've ever invited me to speak there, because the people who controlled the museum have always supported the official story, and that has changed somewhat. So they were able to. Ryan Jones, who is a research director there, was able to organize a speech for me. It went over very well. Had very heavy police security, but it went over very well.
Mm-hmm. So does it seem like people running that museum are having second thoughts, or what?
There's a new administration, and yes, they're definitely having second thoughts.
So where are we now? You've written three books on this, and you have talked at the National Civil Rights Museum and here on KBOO. I guess you've done all you can. Is that correct?
Well, in terms of this case, yes. I don't think there's anything more really that we can do. The plot to kill King tells the final story of how Martin King was killed.
Mm-hmm.
He was not killed by the bullet that Frank Strausser fired. We know Strausser was the shooter. We have the testimony of Lenny Curtis that he was practicing with that rifle all day, and he was capable of shooting. And he left at 3 o'clock. He had been previously talking about how he was going to get King, or how King's head was going to be blown off, that sort of thing. So we know he was the shooter. Earl Clark was his spotter. Earl Clark went down over the wall after the shot. He ran up Mulberry and got into a waiting police car and was taken away. James was over at another gas station trying to get a tire repaired, and he was nowhere near the scene of the crime at the time of the shooting, so there's no question that James is innocent of the crime. Martin was hit by Strauss's bullet. He was not killed, but he was in very bad shape, and he might not have survived the bullet, but he was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital, and they began work on him in the emergency room there. Then Breen Bland, who is the head of neurosurgery at the hospital, came in with two men in suits, and he said to the people working on him, on Martin, stop working on that nigger, let him die, and now all of you get out of here. And he ordered all of the hospital staff who were working in the emergency room to leave, and they all left, and Nurse Shelby, who was a surgical nurse, was the last one to go out, and as she was going out the door, she heard them gather up spit in their mouths like this. And I caught her attention, so she turned around, and she saw the three of them spitting on the body of Dr. King. Then she saw Dr. Bland take a pillow and put it over his head and suffocate him. Kill him.
So then the nurse saw that?
She saw that. And she saw how Martin King was eventually killed, ultimately killed. She then gathered the next morning when she was allowed home, she gathered her family around her and said to them, I don't know why they had to kill him. And she told them that whole story. One of her children, Jonathan Shelby, was a witness of ours, and he came in. He's a diabetic, he's blind, but he told the story just as his mother told it to him. And there's no question that he's telling the truth, and that's what she saw. But beyond that, a few weeks earlier, the same Dr. Breen Bland was the family doctor for the Adkins family, the Dixie Mafia family. And he was out at their house talking to the eldest son about the assassination. And he said, now, if the bullet doesn't kill him, make sure you send him to St. Joseph's Hospital, and we'll make sure that he never leaves. So we have these two independent effective witnesses giving us this information with dovetails with each other. And I have no doubt that that's how Martin King was killed. Now, he might have died from the bullet wound anyway. That's conceivable. But that's not what happened. They weren't going to take any chances. They weren't going to take any chances on him bringing 500,000 people to Washington who could turn into a revolutionary group when they were refused what they were going to be asking for. That is a change in budgetary allocations from the war to social services.
Well, I think
they were going to then possibly become a radicalized revolutionary group.
Well, I think we'll sort of end this segment there. I hope this story continues, because it needs to be, it needs to get out more than it has. And we've been talking with William Pepper, who's an attorney, colleague of Dr. King, and the author of three books on the assassination. The latest is A Plot to Kill King, and it includes corroborating evidence. It includes court documents and testimony. And I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us.
Well, you're welcome. I hope it serves your purpose, and I hope it alerts some of the people in the greater Portland area of
Well, I think we need to do that. That's our purpose, and thank you again for being with us, William F. Pepper.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot, Pear. Bye.
Goodbye. Well, I hope this story is not over. It's been 50 years now since Martin Luther King was assassinated by basically by the War Party, which wins every election we've ever had. Whoops, phone is still on. But anyway, I will end this show now that the War Party is still with us, still making plans for war. And I'd like to thank you for being with us on Fight the Empire.
Uncle Joe, it's raining and the people are so kind of staying around. How great it is. Oh, it makes me feel happy.
Oh, yeah.
Just to know we can study the rain and sing. And the people are so sweet to stay here.
Oh, it is sweet.
And I come in on them.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what I come in on. Oh, yeah! Give me a key. You know it did, didn't it? Oh, oh, yes. How it rained. I said it rained, children. Rain, oh, yes. Didn't it? Yes, didn't it? You know it did, or didn't it? Oh, my Lord, how it rained. You know it rained 40 days, rained 40 nights. To make my garment fit me right. And when I get to heaven,
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. For the past hour, you've been listening to Per Fogering interview William Pepper, a King family friend and attorney who wrote the book, The Plot to Kill King. You can find more information about that on our website, kboo.fm. You can also listen to the full interview there as well, and a podcast. Coming up next is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15 Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, the bike show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon and beyond. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member.
Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting this great station. And you can apply today to join our board of directors to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to great use. The role played by our KBOO board of directors is essential. It's a great way to become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month, and you must be a KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm and fill out an application, or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is April 16, 2018. We need folks who love KBOO and are committed to our community values. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, April 4th, 2018, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Community, diversity,